Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, great to be with you.
And on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. Hope you're doing well.
You too. We're all smiles and friendly in the studio, but what is it?
We're all back to school.
Well, a world on fire, or what a mess. But I'm looking at the Middle East right now, and I'm thinking what it would be like to live in Tel Aviv or Amman, Jordan, or Beirut. These places are, how close are they, John?
Well, Jerusalem to Amman, Jordan is like 55 miles, something like that. It's pretty close.
Pretty darn close. And
that's kind of Salt Lake to Payson.
Yeah. 100 Israeli warplanes striking about 40 sites in Lebanon on Sunday morning. You know, it just, there's no peace here.
There's no peace. And this kind of chaos, I think it's hard for people who've never experienced it to imagine what kind of uncertainty this brings for folks. You think about everything from the disruption this has, the loss of life, certainly, but then like thinking the layering on top of that, just the anxiety, the noise, the constant fear.
Yeah. So the big, power quote, if you will, on this issue from Vice President Harris during her nomination speech at the Democratic National Committee, she said this: President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination.
Something for everyone.
Yeah. Did she get it right, though, John?
Well, I mean, in terms of talking points, yes. Of course, if you can address everything. But in practicality, we've seen conflicts there for generations.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's easy to say, I'm going to solve all these problems. It's really hard to find a solution. Otherwise, a solution would have been found already.
How did you hear that for both of you? I'm curious, her sort of foreign policy, small section of the speech. How did that read to you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm getting asked a lot of questions from people like, who do you support, Natalie, in this election?
And Nikki Haley.
And I've heard business leaders say, Vice President Harris, she's just dumb. And I'm like, where is that coming from? She's a bright woman in my estimation. I'm looking at you, John, to see if you agree.
I've seen a few snippets of interviews, and I get that they can easily be cherry-picked.
Yeah, but she's basically
an
intelligent.
Some of those out there have made it sound like you're not very smart. But it's kind of like George Bush. He was much smarter than we kind of recognize because he was caricatured so much on some of his
speaking. I've seen her as a deeply competent woman. I just might not agree with her on ideology, but I think her recall, her native intelligence, her understanding of our system, her understanding of policy, I think she's very well qualified, even if ideologically I might be different.
Well, and I can give a different example. Okay, Gerald Ford might have been the most athletic president we've ever had, yet he was caricatured as clumsy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is how Chevy Chase kind of made his name to fame on Saturday Night Live, mocking Ford.
But to your question, Shireen, I thought it was reasonable. I didn't take issue with it. I liked the specificity, even though it's not, everyone says, where's the specifics? I'm like, well, that's not what this speech is about.
Yeah.
But she's got a general understanding and an ability to work through and be, someone who makes a final judgment on some issues.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. When you think about the experience she's had over the last 3.5 years, I guess maybe one of the things that's in the back of my mind is this sort of sense that, well, she's shifted on her policies. Well, so is her experience. I mean, radically shifted, right?
Yeah.
So when you think about the ways in which you come into a presidential campaign, most people are kind of faking foreign policy expertise.
For sure.
This is not something that most people have the opportunity to develop. And those who do are often in very specialized roles inside of large, departments.
I'm totally with you. It's a small group.
It's a small group of people. So I found this to be a little hawkish, honestly. I found not this statement specifically, but kind of the broader section.
Well, and this is the point to me, though, if she's shifting, if she's becoming more moderate or hawkish, whatever, however you want to create, I like it.
Yeah, I had a feeling you might.
Well, what was Senator Romney or Mitt Romney characterized as a flip-flopper? And I'm like, it's okay if you flip-flop to a better place.
Yeah. And I think there's a big difference between representing the people of California and representing the United States of America, right?
Yeah.
You would hope that people would have a sense of adaptability to that. I just would also say that when I think about, kind of control, calm, reasoned thinking, and I think about what a second Trump presidency is offering, there is no comparison.
Well, and from my perspective, the way it came across to me is, a big swath of the Democratic Party is viewed from the Republican side as being pro-Israel, I mean, anti-Israel, pro-Palestine. Okay. And so I looked at this and various others looked at it and saying, okay, she is trying to touch the base sufficiently to say, okay, I'm not anti-Israel. Yeah. Okay. While still, you know, throwing, you know, something, a bone out there for Palestinians to say, I want to solve this to try and address that part of the wing of the Democratic Party.
John, so, you're seeing me smile because I think you characterized it right about, you know, pro-Israel, pro-Palestinian, whatever. And on the Republican side, the Republicans are seen as pro-Russia and the Democrats as pro-Ukraine. What a mixed up world or party system we have.
Yeah. When you talk about people living, unfortunately, in Israel, I'm told they have to deal with threats and bombings and stuff regularly, things that we can never imagine.
Can't imagine.
And the kind of devastation Gaza is experiencing is known to native communities in this country, but otherwise no one else.
Hey. And then you look at what's going on in Ukraine and just...
Yeah. So the vice president's raised $540 million in the last month.
Is that all?
And it's a stunning amount of money. And it, you know, I asked myself the question, she's apparently not doing the, you know, level of media access and interviews that people think she should be doing. She doesn't have to. She can go buy the attention she needs with that much money. I just think that's interesting.
Well, and she's still, I believe, in her honeymoon period. Mm-hmm. And it's in her interest to be able to tell her narrative and not have to be responding to others. Yeah. And she's, from my perspective, getting a pass on that right now.
Yeah. Shireen, two endorsements that are pretty interesting. So RFK Jr.'s come out, of course. He was an independent presidential campaign, now has endorsed Trump. Where do you think this swings on the election?
So there was a lot of uncertainty about what Kennedy's role would be in terms of a spoiler. Was that taking votes from Trump or from Harris? And then there was the story about how the Kennedy and I think the campaign, you know, approached both of these candidates to say, hey, I'll drop out if I can get a role in your administration, which is wild, considering that many of the views that he holds, and talk about somebody who's a bit of a chaos agent and pretty undisciplined. So what I think this says to me is that either Trump said, just tell him yes, or he ran out of money and thought that this would be his best bet to staying relevant. So I know there were a lot of financial troubles in this campaign. I guess I would just suggest to people that if you feel like Kennedy was your candidate, I understand there's plenty of reasons to vote third party or, you know, to vote for somebody outside of the major parties. But in swing states, I would just ask people to really look at what these candidates are offering when we think about the next 4 years.
John, how about the family statement? And I loved how they called him our brother Bobby, you know, just to remind people of that strong connection to RFK. But they said it's a sad ending to a sad story.
Interesting. That's a strong statement.
Yeah.
Strong statement.
It is. John, Tulsi Gabbard has also, so this is the former congressman from Hawaii, a Democrat, but she's endorsing Trump. Does that one matter?
I don't know if it matters, but she has been a darling of the Republican Party for many years because she's been viewed as a person that's concerned about all the warmongering in the world and the U.S. playing too big of a role in that. She's also been a Kamala Harris skeptic.
Yeah.
And so because of that, many Republicans have liked her, felt like she's been speaking out. And so this doesn't really surprise me.
Let's do a lightning round on some of these things. A lot of press that Vice President Harris is baiting Trump in a really clever way. She's tweeting out things about, you know, will you debate or not? And has a chicken clucking in the background. You heard that, Shireen, apparently. I saw it on CNN and they said the sound effects are from the campaign, not us. Because it's like they show a picture of the tweet, but then you hear this cluck, 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 you know, like your chicken. This is on the issue of muted.
She's punking him and stuff like that.
Do you think the debate will happen? And who do you think advantages?
I think it advantages her. I think, again, back to this notion of discipline and the ability to control yourself under extreme circumstances. Trump does not have a pattern of this. And I think having his mic shut off was a bad idea for Biden.
You agree, John?
I think it actually is a way for Trump to shine. He surprisingly does well in the debates relative to others. And so if she has a poor showing and he has a good showing, then that bodes well for him.
They're saying that the muted mic makes the news story about the muted mic, and then it's about, you know, debating. And this is Harris ultimately being successful because you're not talking about policies.
Yep.
Interesting. What about whether, you know, whether this $540 million really amounts to something big for the campaigns.
Yes. I think when you think about the energy that comes into a campaign in terms of diversifying the donor base and also thinking about the power that somebody like Bernie Sanders built across many small dollar donations, that is more of what we're seeing in this Harris in the Harris contributions, certainly many mega donors as well. But Biden was not seeing that.
Yeah.
Well, I think it also shows that a lot of Democrats were sitting on their hands. They were frustrated with Biden. They were going to support him at the end of the day, but had no confidence. And so now there's excitement behind somebody new that they think there's a future to build on.
John, being a part of a congressional campaign, your public record on this is quite clear. But what do you think of, I mean, just of this in general, but what do you think of former President Trump hosting a gala honoring January 6th defendants? Seems like 20 defendants arrested for taking part in the January 6th, whether you call it insurrection or protest, hosting a gala for them?
Assault on the Capitol.
Yeah.
So if you're celebrating those that attacked police officers, broke into the Capitol and so forth, reprehensible from my perspective. No questions asked.
Well, and I think that this is where Trump's campaign leaders are going, come on. I don't think they think, I mean, this is not discipline. This is just trying to get attention.
Yep, that's right.
Last question in this segment. You saw how Governor Cox, accompanied by former President Donald Trump, went to the wreath laying ceremony honoring Staff Sergeant Darren Taylor Hoover of Sandy. John, just go to you first on this. This is a real interesting juxtaposition now where Cox and Trump are now being photographed together, getting news together. You read on that. It all comes from his letter where he witnessed the assassination attempt and felt compelled to build bridges with Donald Trump.
So I think it shows that he is trying to build bridges, trying to build some relationship there. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I think for Trump, he also views it as an opportunity to kind of take a dig at the Biden administration, their failings. You know, when you look at what took place, you know, in Afghanistan.
The withdrawal,
uh-huh. The disastrous withdrawal. I would put blame on both of them because Trump put in a timeline and Biden executed on the timeline poorly. I mean, it was a difficult timeline and executed poorly. There's blame for both of them in that disaster.
Shireen, last word on that.
I would just say fundamentally, there is a long record of Biden taking very seriously, having had a child in the military. Each day, his card that has his agenda printed on it also has active information about our active duty members, those whose lives have been lost, their names. This is something he holds near and dear to his heart. And yes, there have been disasters. There certainly are, I think, under any administration when we think about the military. But when we think about the way that Trump has denigrated and diminished members of any military service in this country repeatedly, and then showing up and doing, I don't know if you saw the photo, but the thumbs up at the gravesite, I feel like it's just disrespectful. So I just am not going to take Trump's presence there as a shift in respecting those who serve this country.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a short break. Stay tuned, everybody. This is Both Sides of the Aisle.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. We are in studio.
Natalie, the referee.
Two or three feet from each other and just smiling as we try to bring you great,
stare down.
Great content on public affairs here on Both Sides of the Aisle. Let's start with this. I'll just call it a crowd of about 350 people waving signs and chanting vote no. And they're talking about the constitutional amendment on the initiative petition. Shireen, you were probably there.
You bet I was.
Oh, you're kidding. Okay.
Tell us what the story was on the ground.
Yeah. Sure. The story on the ground is there was a bipartisan showing, including Senator Dan Thatcher and other Republicans who came out, not in our legislature. He was the only member of the legislature, but who came out to really suggest that this is what I think many Utahns see it as, is a power grab. And I would just caution people, because I think what you're going to see, because the legislature also passed the ability for them to, I would say, rather carefully and maybe cleverly word the language on these constitutional amendments. There will be two this fall. But I would just suggest that both of these are a step in the wrong direction for Utah. When we think about the argument, the hysteria, honestly, that Republicans in our legislature are saying the Supreme Court ruling on the better boundaries on fair districts is presenting, what they're suggesting is that they have no ability, that there are these super laws that are created by ballot initiatives, and there's no ability for the legislature to amend or fix or change to make sure that they are reasonable laws or comply or maybe address some kind of fine details around the edges. That is a misreading. That is a misinterpretation, frankly, of what was ruled in the lawsuit. The lawsuit said they do have the ability to amend these laws. What they cannot do is repeal the intent of what voters set out to do. This is absolutely bonkers. And you're going to hear that it's about foreign funding. It's about this or that. It's about a power grab.
Okay. So, John, what Shireen just did was very artfully articulate an easy public message on this.
There's a very easy public message to say vote too much government for me,
legislature getting more power,
taking your vote away,
taking your voice away.
And we don't have time in the program to go to it, but if a little deeper look would tell you that there's some legitimate concerns about two different types of laws, one that can't be touched.
Well, we already have two different types. Constitutional and statutory.
Yeah.
Now we layer in this third type, which is kind of super statute, which is not constitutional, but basically what Shireen said. The court said when it comes to reforming government, the legislature has to respect the intent of the initiative.
And
now they can alter it and amend it some, but they have to respect the intent, which means you can't just up and repeal it if you think it's a bad idea. And so therefore the legislature is very concerned.
Yeah.
Are we going to end up in a world in which we have more and more initiatives in Utah driving how we reform government?
Which
and
makes
where the line
my
is.
Point that if you're explaining, you're losing, and I think this will
so
go
I
down.
I just lost.
I think this might go down in flames because I really understand where the legislature's coming from, and I don't think it was as much of an emergency as they projected it to be, but I also think it's more of a problem than Shireen thinks it is. And so we go from there. Well, I'm in the political
and
middle.
And if you look at the timeline, if they have to wait for two more years before so they can
be
put
some
on
trouble.
The ballot.
Yeah, there could be some trouble. Okay, let's go to something else here. Federal land ownership. John, how do I set this up? But the federal government owns about two-thirds of the land in Utah.
Yep.
There's only one state in the lower 48 that has a higher share of federal land. That's Nevada. Yeah. The one that
87%.
Has more is Alaska. That's why we say lower 48. But the state's basically saying for all of the land, what's the term they used? Unappropriated land that's not national monuments.
So they're
national
suing
parks.
The federal government saying you made a promise at statehood that you would divest yourself of public lands in Utah. So they're saying in their lawsuit, we're not going to question military bases, national parks, and those type of pieces of land. But everything else, we're questioning, saying, hey, in the Enabling Act at statehood, you said you would sell this off. And a portion of the money you made would come back into basically a trust fund for the state, for school,
so
and you're not doing it. You're reneging.
I have two comments on this.
Yeah.
One is, why is it taking us so long?
Wow.
If it's been there since statehood, and we've been having public land arguments since, you know, forever, but Sagebrush Rebellion is the first I remember, and that was in the 70s.
Late 70s, early 80s, yep.
I love it that you can that.
Under a Democratic governor.
Yeah.
But the second thing I would point out is, be careful what you ask for. Do you really want to maintain all of these lands? I just throw that out there. The wildfire, the species and things that you have to deal with, the noxious weeds, on and on and on. I'm a huge proponent of us getting the land that has economic development value, contribute to our tax base. So land that is around cities, land that has water readily available. But some of the land, I think they're doing us a favor to help us manage it.
So I'll say that this is I believe that we're seeing some real propaganda from our government on this. The ad that is showing.
That's a big word, Shireen.
I mean it. The ad that's showing, a family going to a campsite. There's a metal ring, fire ring at that campsite. And then a child, I guess, apparently decides to bring his family back there and the road is closed. Right. And so this is kind of all part of the story that they're telling.
I've not seen this, but that sounds like a pretty good ad.
Oh, it was put out by our state.
Yeah.
So let me
federal
just.
The federal government is locking up a bunch of the roads and trails.
Okay. So they are. A portion, it is less than what they have kept open, to be clear, across the roads that have been closed. Additionally, the cost of managing that is a lot. If you let people drive everywhere, when we're thinking about the impact to the environment, search and rescue, when we think about the impact.
Boy, search and rescue is an interesting one.
Huge. Yeah. Massive. When we think about.
Be careful what you ask for.
Yeah.
Well, fire
it matters
management.
What land you own.
That's right.
Is my point.
Yeah. But
I'll just say
search
this.
Search and rescue, we're having to foot the bill to rescue folks. on federal lands.
Okay, and maybe it would be less if we had more control over where these individuals were. I mean, a huge part of the cost is actually finding, searching for some of these individuals, okay? So let's go back to Natalie's point, which is be careful what you ask for. If we think about these lands coming into state control, they were never in state control, to be clear, right? Who is going to pay for that? The taxpayers of Utah are. Already, the federal government allows us to have access to these lands. And one of the things that really frustrated me when I was running for Congress was that I would hear over and over again that really when people had lost access to land was when it went into private hands. And if this huge amount, a vast amount of land comes into the control of this state, there is no way that this state will raise the taxes necessary to effectively and efficiently manage this land as wild spaces.
It's not
enough. They will sell it off.
It's not enough of what they pay, but just to remind our listeners, the federal government does make a payment in lieu of taxes for this land.
Correct.
It's a per acre payment.
Yeah,
correct.
We call it pennies in lieu of taxes, but yes. But but one of the challenges is when it comes to energy extraction, oil, gas, uranium, whatever it might be, a lot of that is on public lands, which is heavily restricted. Mm-hmm. So we don't just have free access to that.
Sure. But then I guess I'm saying that if this came into the control of the state, how are we going to pay for this?
Yeah.
You'll see more of this land sold off, and you will not, as average everyday Utahns who love to camp, fish, and hunt, you are not going to have access to this land.
I think there's part that's going to be sold off and part that's going to be kept by the state. So.
When in, you know, this is not true in most states, but in Washington, D.C., the most important building to the state of Utah is the Department of Interior.
Yeah.
And it's because of this point, because the federal government is such a large landowner.
Folks, and whoever controls the land controls the economy.
Well,
our economy is doing great, so it seems like it's working out fine.
Well, but talk about different aspects of the state.
She thinks quick on her feet, John. But my point would be, you know, there's a better way. And let's just figure out a really wonderful land exchange, land trade, something of the lands that are real. The lawsuits... They just don't go anywhere. I was a part of 11 and a half years of the Mike Leavitt administration trying so hard to deal with RS-2477 roads, and we were suing and we were doing all these things, and it hasn't amounted to a lot.
Let me just help folks with numbers. So we said 2/3 of the state, so call it 67%, is public lands in Utah. Compare that to Texas, it's something like 3%. Compare that to Connecticut, it's like 0.3%. Mm-hmm. So just to help folks understand kind of the magnitude of the issue in the West.
I just also want to quickly touch on why now. I think it's because we have a supermajority Republicans on the Supreme Court is why now. Mm-hmm. And I think, honestly, this has to do with Cox positioning himself as a particular kind of Republican, given the pressure he's getting from Phil Lyman. I think that's why we're seeing it now.
Well, I think the other thing that comes into play is we have been working on this actively for about a decade, and it's finally coming to fruition of being able to start filing the lawsuits that some of us were wishing we'd pursue years ago.
Yeah. Waste of money. Let's go.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, I'm really interested in the conversation. Let's see what happens. We've also gotten, John, you know so much about this, but we've got a review of the Utah election process that's being conducted by your office. You're calling it a limited review. You're going to look at the validation process for...
there's actually
signature gathering and the controls over voter registration info.
There's actually my office is looking into it as well as the Legislative Auditor General. So
are you doing it jointly?
Not jointly, but we're coordinating among each other so we don't step on each other and we're not.
We don't place
too much of a burden.
So what's the rationale for both?
Well, so the rationale is I actually started about 6 weeks ago and had checked with the Legislative Auditor General to see whether this was in their scope or not. It was not, and we had touched bases a few times over the last few weeks. It was not. I was waiting for the litigation to largely clear to then engage on the audit. It turns out legislative leaders got antsy on their side and wanted to test their auditors. So actually, Tuesday a week ago, I called up the Legislative Auditor General, said, hey, I just sent my official notice off to the LG to inform her that we were starting the audit. He goes, oh, I was just going to call you because we were just informally requested, and this afternoon they will officially request that we engage in an audit.
So Shireen's smiling, and this is very executive legislative branchy, right? Because John's in the executive branch, has the responsibility for doing these kinds of things. The legislature knows they don't control John, but they do control their side of the audit. And that smells to me of some friction between executive and legislative.
I think that's right. I'll also just offer to our listeners that we're going to have a special episode coming up where we talk to a county clerk about election processes, because I do think that there is a fundamental misunderstanding of the idea of a canvas and how this works.
Yeah,
I'll just note that the legislative auditor team is a very professional team. And they engage in a professional manner.
Totally agree.
And they were already engaged in other election-related audit activities. And that's why I called them to see if this was in their scope or not. And we are looking at two prongs.
Yeah.
I describe it as the privacy issue, the control over and the disclosure of protected information.
John, that's fair. And I am,
as well as
I appreciate the complexity of this. And I do think both of these offices are very competent at what they do. And in economics, we love multiple points of view looking at things. In the last minute, let's talk just for a minute about Senate candidate John Curtis. He seems to be, everything seems to be falling in line for him to be our next U.S. Senator replacing Mitt Romney. He's got a 34% lead among registered voters. And if you make some adjustments, he's even got a larger lead. Looks like we've got our next senator coming up here.
Yeah, I would just encourage people to take a look at Caroline Gleick. She's running a really smart, energized campaign. She is a young person who is not an insider to politics, who brings a lot of passion for the environment, for reproductive freedom, I would think would represent us well.
Yeah, John, quick comment. And
who is she? Because most folks are going to say, I've never heard
of her. Got like 30 seconds.
So she is the other candidate. She is the Democrat. She's an outdoorist. She is a really smart and interesting person.
And John Curtis is a hardworking guy, and I think he's going to run to victory in the general election.
But your point is well taken, Shereen. Hey, it's been a great conversation. Thanks so much, friends. Shereen Gourbani and John Dougal. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.